You began your career emceeing a teen talent show in Nashville. Won't you please tell us more about that?
Sure. I was a junior and senior in high school, and I loved to sing, and I was performing and known to be a young singer around Nashville, a very musical town. And my high school principal had a friend who owned and ran one of the biggest radio stations in Nashville, and he came up with the idea, I can't say it was my idea, for a teenage talent program on Saturday mornings, which I still think is a great idea. I think it would be great if it was national. But this was radio, and I was the host on WSIX in Nashville, and still sounding like a real Southern boy, but that was fine because I was in the South. And I interviewed young talent, introduced young talent, and of course sang a song or two myself. A fellow who played wonderful piano, any song, any key. He was amazing. Frank Bobo was his name. And so I even wound up doing commercials because eventually there were some sponsors who wanted to come aboard this show that was attracting a lot of teenagers in the afternoon. So it was called Youth on Parade. And it was a lot of fun. It was great training for me.
What sorts of things did you do?
Well, of course, I sang occasional pop song. Every week I did at least one song, whatever the current songs were, and then interviewed whoever the other young talents were that could perform on radio, usually singers or pianists or instrumentalists, and then occasionally a commercial, just like a regular radio guy.
You made your first recordings for Dot Records in 1955. Won't you please tell us more about that?
Yeah, I was performing, as I say, all over Nashville. I entered various talent contests and often came in second. And the one who usually was number one in these talent contests around town, and sometimes with big audiences and big auditoriums, they were usually a pianist, a tap dancer, an instrumentalist, a violinist, or even an opera classically trained singer. And they would, of course, impress either the judges or sometimes even the audience, because obviously these are kids that had trained and had really worked at it. I was just a guy singing current pop songs, so no big deal. In Nashville, seemed like anybody could do that. But I did win a Nashville area-wide talent contest that sent me to New York with an audition for the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, which was the American Idol show of its day, and on national television, a big, big show. And I was pleased since I won the talent contest, not to let my hometown down by at least getting on the show. And I was 18, and I sang, "I believe for every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows," and won. And I won that week, and I won the next week, and the week after, because the voters, the winners were decided by cards and letters coming in on, and about Thursday of the week following your performance, the winner had been decided, and the winner would be brought back for another week. And so if you won 3 weeks in a row, which I did, then you qualified for a finals against other three-time winners, whenever that might happen. And for me, it was about a year and a half before there were other three-time winners. In the meantime, I married my high school sweetheart. We moved to Denton, Texas. I transferred to North Texas State from David Lipscomb, a Christian college in Nashville. And I had almost forgotten, if you can believe it, about the Ted Mack Amateur Hour until they called and said, "Hey, we need you to come back because we've got enough three-time winners now to have a kind of a showdown of all the three-time winners, and you're one of them." And so I went back to New York for that.
And that's how you ended up on Dot Records.
It is, because that created a tremendous celebratory thing in Nashville. A local boy on Nashville television, on national television, not only the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, but the Arthur Godfrey Talent Scout Show, which was a professional show on Monday nights. And since I was there waiting in New York, having performed with the other three-time winners on the Ted Mack show, I went over and auditioned for the Arthur Godfrey show, and to my astonishment, was put on that night, and I won. And so now I was competing as a professional, and you can't be a professional winner on Monday and then declared an amateur winner the following Saturday. So I blew the college scholarship they said I would have won on the Ted Mack show, and I could have used it. Shirley and I were now expecting our first child already, and just barely 20. And I stopped in Nashville on my way back to Denton to visit my folks, and Randy Wood of Dot Records, based outside Nashville, asked me to come see him, and we committed a verbal contract. Nothing was signed, but he said, look, we'll look for a song we think can be a hit. We'll call you out there in Denton, and you go out and have your baby and get back in school. We'll call you, and we'll see if we can make a hit record. It was 8 months after that. And again, I thought I had just about forgotten about Dot Records, because I thought they'd forgotten about me. But Randy Wood called in March of 1955 and said, I'll send you a ticket, fly to Chicago, let's make a record of a song called Two Hearts, Two Kisses, Make One Love. And that was a rhythm and blues hit already by the Charms on the Dutone label, or R&B label. And that turned out to be a million-selling record, my very first record. And the next was Ain't That a Shame, a million-selling number one. And I decided I better take a crack at this singing thing.
According to one poll conducted in the mid-1950s, you were actually more popular than Elvis.
Well, I can't say yes to that. I mean, that's up to somebody else to say, but we were very, very friendly. We were two boys from Tennessee and very competitive with each other, both singing rock and roll at that time. I made my first movie just a month or two before he made his first film. We were both under contract at 20th then. In 1957, after we were matching each other hit for hit, he went to the Army, and I became, according to all the polls, the number one pop singer in the world, and Elvis was off in the Army. But, of course, he came back from the Army and resumed his career, and after that, I think he assumed the number one position. But they do say, the record seems to show, that in the 50s, I was his only real competition and virtually matched him hit for about 5 years.
He once opened for you at a 1955 gig in Cleveland. He was an unknown at that time, not the superstar he'd become later. What was it like sharing a stage with Elvis? What was he
well,
like? Well,
I didn't share the stage. I shared backstage with Elvis, because this was a big sock hop, which was a very popular thing at the time. And Elvis was brought up by the DJ who was hosting it, Bill Randall, at WERE in Cleveland. And the number one, most popular, most influential DJ in the country. And he asked me to come in from New York. I had transferred to Columbia University. I was in school, but also having hit records. And this was only in October of 55. And my third record was on its way to being my third million seller since March. And so I went to headline his sock hop for about 3,000 kids in a big high school gymnasium in Cleveland. And Bill brought Elvis, who was considered a rockabilly at that time, hillbilly and rock, down in Louisiana. He was appearing regularly on the Louisiana Hayride and, you know, considered a country singer, though with rock tendencies. And so Bill brought him up, heard he'd been signed to RCA Victor, and his contract from Sun Records had been bought. But nobody had heard him yet nationally, and I'd heard of him. I'd heard his record, his Sun record, on a jukebox in Dallas. And when Bill said, we're bringing Elvis up to be on the show tonight with you, I said, well, Bill, he's a hillbilly. You think he's going to go over in this rock and roll crowd? And he sort of chuckled. He said, we'll see. We said, RCA Victor thinks they have something. So Elvis came back to that stage, backstage that night. We were both waiting for our time to go on in front of 3,000 kids who were dancing to the current records, and Bill, the DJ, was spinning the records. And, you know, I extended my hand and said, "Hi, Elvis, I'm Pat Boone." He said, "Nice to meet you." And, and I said, "Bill Randall says maybe some big things ahead for you, huh?" "Yeah, I don't know about that, but I hope so." And he just backed against the wall with his little entourage. He seemed very shy. Bill introduced him to a crowd that didn't know him at all. He came out, he lip-synced his record, which was a Flat and Scruggs bluegrass song called "Blue Moon of Kentucky." "Blue Moon of Kentucky, keep on shining." Well, that wasn't happening in that beginning of the rock and roll era. It was really bluegrass country. But the kids liked Elvis the way he looked. He wasn't twitching and swiveling his hips at that point, but he was just lip-syncing his record. And he finished that. They gave him a big hand. And he said, "Thank you very much. I'm glad you like that. I want to do the other side of that record for you. I hope you like it." And he sang, "That's all right, Mama. That's all right with me," which was a rhythm and blues song. And they loved that. And they wanted more, but that's all he had. So he left the stage, and then I was introduced. And because I was riding the wave of 3 million selling hits in a row since March of that year, I got all the screams that night. Just another virtual teenage singer. And I didn't see him. When I came off stage, he was gone. And then we met again about a year and a half, 2 years later in Bel Air, where we were both renting homes while we were starting to make movies. And we visited back and forth, and I eventually said, "Elvis, that night we met in Cleveland, you seemed so shy and nervous. I was afraid you were going to, you know, pass out on stage or something. You seemed so shy and nervous." He said, "Well, I don't know how to talk to you, man." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You were a star." I said, "A star? I'd only had 3 records since March." "Yeah, but you were on the charts." And he said, "I just didn't know how to talk to you." So that tells you how basically shy and polite Elvis was. He was very assured when he sang, but talking and socially, he was still in high school. So we got along great. We stayed good friends. We were very competitive with each other, but very admiring of each other. And I miss him.
I think we all miss him. Anyway, according to IMDb.com, you were personally invited by President Eisenhower to perform at his inaugural ball at the White House in 1957. Won't you tell us about that?
Well, that was the first of a number of appearances at inaugural galas and balls with virtually every president from Eisenhower, Truman, of course Nixon and Ford and eventually Reagan, Bush, both Bushes, and up the line. Interestingly, I wasn't generally asked to perform at the Democrat galas because I was known right from the start as a Southern Republican and very conservative. And even though I, of course, always saluted and prayed for and respected whoever our president is, I just was very more active on the Republican and conservative side. So Eisenhower he was such a nice man for a general and a great soldier. He was just compassionate and friendly and communicative. And he knew I was a college student at Columbia, where he had been president of Columbia University briefly. And when we met, he said, "You're in college at Columbia?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "I understand you're married." I said, "Yes, sir, I am." And he said, "You have children already?" I said, "Yes, sir, 3. And I was like 22 at that time, in college with 3 kids and having hit records and starting to make movies, and I was chairman of National Bible Week. And he just shook his head. He was amazed, as I am, and as I look back at it, at how busy and involved I was. And each of these activities was important and successful.
Your likeness was actually in a Superman comic in 1959. That story was called Superman's Mystery Song, and Superman was actually trying to prevent a song of yours from becoming a hit. How'd that come about?
Well, I had nothing to do with it. I was just flattered that because I would say Elvis and I, at that time, we came at just the right moment in pop record history. There was tremendous transition going on. The economy or the marketplace or the salespeople across America in every field had just discovered there was a whole other market called the teen market. Up till then, teens just bought whatever their parents liked and whatever was available, and they just looked like young adults. But there were clothes, there was music, there were all new movies and entertainment of all types. And so Elvis and I were riding that crest. And so it was a tremendously amazing time and a very hectic time. So for me, I don't think Elvis ever did a command performance for the Queen of England, but I did two of those. And it was just a giant wave of popularity, which, you know, it was so new and so, in a way, unprecedented that that we just held on for dear life and tried to do each thing that we were asked to do the best we could.
Speaking, you've spoken of your movies a few times. You've been in quite a few, everything from science fiction to comedy and everything in between. Which one of those was your favorite?
Well, for me, it's two films. One was Journey to the Center of the Earth, which was Jules Verne's story and a huge, huge commercial hit. In fact, they tell me it saved 20th Century Fox at the time because Fox was about to go under and be bankrupted by the banks because they were so over budget and over schedule with Cleopatra, with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, who were vanishing off to Spain for a week at a time in the middle of the shooting of Cleopatra in Rome. And the banks were fed up with it and were about to foreclose because it looked like 20th Century Fox was just going to go bankrupt. And about that time, Journey to the Center of the Earth came out, and it was a huge hit and convinced the bankers to keep 20th Century Fox afloat till they could finish Cleopatra. I didn't know any of that until years later, but it was executives who told me that I hadn't even realized, because I just made the movie, sang the songs. It was quite an ordeal of work, but fun, with James Mason, Arlene Dahl, and doing a tremendous science fiction film. So that's a major favorite, but the other is a lesser known, but it's still in 15 or 20 languages, called The Cross and the Switchblade, which was a film and is still, of course, the story of David Wilkerson and the foundation of Teen Challenge, which is a Christian drug rehabilitation program that is the best there's ever been, with a 74% cure rate of people hooked on drugs to the nth degree. But it's a spiritual program, therefore it can't be legally supported by the government, and so it's a private but widely known and highly successful program helping teens and adults escape from drug addiction. And Dave Wilkerson's story was became a huge best-selling book by that title, The Cross and the Switchblade, and then I played him in the movie, and it too has been instrumental, the film, in helping I don't know how many, who can count, the thousands of people it has encouraged not to take drugs to begin with, and then if they are already hooked, to find a way to come out of the drug addiction. And it's a spiritual program because in some cases only God can help you. You can't do it yourself.
I think I read that book in high school.
Yep, The Cross and the Switchblade. It was very, very big.
You had a novelty hit in 1962, Speedy Gonzales. When did you decide to record what became the hit version of that track, and how did you recruit Mel Blanc, the voice of the actual Speedy Gonzales, to improvise between verse dialogue?
Yeah, well, Mel was the addition and inspiration of Randy Wood, who was the head of our record company. I heard the song first in the Philippines. I was appearing there to packed auditoriums in the Araneta Coliseum, which seated 24,000 people, and I was there 10 straight nights in the Philippines.
Wow.
With 24,000 people a night. It's almost like Neil Diamond may do today, or Elvis. But it was sensational, and while I was there one night off, or after my show, it wasn't a night off, I went to a little after-hours place that a TV director owned, and they want me to sing, and I said, no, I'm tired, I've already sung, I just want to relax and enjoy this place and being away from the Coliseum. And so the owner got up with a little combo, and people were screaming Speedy Gonzales at him. I thought that's what they called him. But he, with his back to the crowd and the mic in his hand, he went, la, 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 and just, and, you know, in a falsetto voice, which I don't do. And the people started getting excited, and he whirled, and he started singing Speedy Gonzales. And it was very exciting. I said, what is that? I haven't heard that. He said, don't you know that? It's a big, big hit here in the Philippines. I said, no, I've never heard of it. And it was a record, but not a hit, in the United States by an RCA artist named David Dante, or Dante. But it just hadn't caught on. But I thought, man, that is a hit song if I ever heard it. So I bought his record home, played it for Randy Wood of Dot Records, and eventually convinced him, because I was now doing movie themes, things like that. He said, they don't want you to sing rock and roll anymore. I said, Randy, this is a hit, and no matter what you call it. And so he did. We recorded it. It went to number one quicker than any record I ever had. And then, but as we were recording, we needed the voice of Speedy. And so we got Mel Blanc, who it turned out had been the voice of Speedy Gonzales in some Warner Brothers cartoons. So he was already used to being Speedy. In fact, that spurred a lawsuit by an over-eager lawyer at Warner's who was trying to hold Dot and me responsible for using their cartoon character without permission in my record, which, of course, was idiotic of him, because we were popularizing a character that they owned. However, the judge ruled, because it did go to court, and the judge ruled that the person or the character of Speedy Gonzales was like a folk figure, had been around a long time before Warner's made a movie, a cartoon about him, and that it was public domain. Therefore, we could have turned around and sued Warner Brothers for malicious prosecution, but we didn't. We just settled for having a multi-million-selling number one hit around the world.
You had a TV show in the late 60s that featured some now familiar names in the entertainment world. Richard Pryor, William Shatner, and a then-new band from England calling themselves Pink Floyd. Won't you please tell us more about that?
Well, sure. By the time we settled down in Hollywood, moved away from Teaneck, New Jersey, when I was doing my own TV show, the Pat Boone Chevy Show on ABC back there. And I graduated from Columbia University, magna cum laude, I'm proud to say. And so we moved to California. And, of course, with now four kids, I was looking for some way to still make records and be an entertainer, but without traveling as much. And so I agreed to do an afternoon syndicated show like Mike Douglas was doing at that time, Merv Griffin. And so we started it. It was called Pat Boone in Hollywood. And because we were filming at the Vine Street Theater, which is where Merv Griffin did his shows, we could attract all the top names. We had Jack Benny and Bob Hope and of course I had Richard Pryor. I made him my guest host, co-host for a week, and I had to caution him, Richard, this is family audience now, be careful. And he was very, very funny, and he was clean, which shows that all funny, genuinely funny people can be funny without being dirty. And that's another campaign of mine to try to convince my comic buddies like Buddy Hackett and so many others to keep it clean. I think their career will last longer and appeal to more people. But anyway, the show was a success. However, it was the first venture for a company called Filmways into syndication. And they had unreal expectations that a newly launched show in syndication going maybe into the third station in any given market would take a while to gain a foothold. After 13 weeks, they hadn't arrived at the ratings they thought they needed to have, and so they canceled the production and ran reruns for the next 13 weeks, and the ratings kept going up during the rerun period, but they'd already canceled the show. But I still have lots of film and tape and pictures of all those great people. We had Dustin Hoffman, who came on. He just filmed The Graduate, and he participated in comic skits and, of course, interviews, and, you know, it solidified my image in Hollywood as somebody who could host a show as well as appear on one.
You'll forgive me. I totally forgot about the Pat Boone Chevy Show. Won't you please tell us more about that?
Well, I was having hit record after hit record in 56 and into 57, just one record after another. In fact, I did not believe this myself when the statistics were put in front of me. I was writing my own autobiography called Pat Boone's America, 50 Years. That from March of 55, when Two Hearts, Two Kisses was my first record on Dot and became a million seller, top 10, then Ain't That a Shame, and then At My Front Door or Crazy Little Mama, at the time I met Elvis in 50, in October of that first year. From March of 55 to February of 56, when Elvis hit the scene with his first record, Heartbreak Hotel, I had 6 million-selling singles, and 2 of them number ones, in 11 months. Well, that was gigantic. It's never been done by anybody. Even Elvis didn't do it. The Beatles, nobody did that in that period of time. And so... of course, 20th Century Fox came running. They wanted me to make movies. ABC Television wanted me to do TV. And enterprising young guy that I was, with 4 kids to think about getting married and putting through college, or in reverse order, hopefully, I agreed to do the TV show, Pat Boone Chevy Showroom for Chevrolet, and took a break now and then and did movies for 20th Century Fox. All of this while I was still in college. I graduated in 1958 at age 23 with 4 kids, the number one show on TV, the Pat Boone Chevy Showroom in the Nielsens, having already made 3 hit movies. And I was on the cover of TV Guide in my cap and gown. Open it up, and there's Shirley and the 4 little girls. I mean, this was a hectic, unbelievable, unparalleled kind of a skyrocketing career. Elvis hit with a big avalanche of popularity, but he was single, and he could play the field and date, and he wasn't in college, and he wasn't involved in a lot of the things I was. He didn't do TV, rarely made television appearances, but I was doing everything at once, and it was a hectic time.
Impressive, to say the least. In 1971, you played the main character Holston on an installment of Rod Serling's Night Gallery called The Academy. Did you get to meet Rod Serling?
Oh, yes, met Rod, and he was a gentleman, very enterprising himself, very creative. And it was his idea that I, with my wholesome image, go against a type and play a character that was not as fatherly and as familial as I am in real life. And by then, I was trying to shun some of the adjectives that were used about me. Oh, that nice guy. Oh, he's such a clean-cut, all-American guy. I loved all that. I wanted to be that. But here was Elvis, who was playing the field and breaking the rules, and the rebel, I was the guy playing by all the rules. So I thought maybe it would be good to show that, at least in an acting performance, I could play somebody that was not like me in my real life. And I did two or three of those things. I did a movie called The Pigeon with Sammy Davis, sponsored by Aaron Spelling. And produced by Aaron Spelling. And I played the guy who actually was the villain of the piece. You didn't know it till later. I did a movie called The Yellow Canary with Jack Klugman. And I played a pop singer who had a good image, but was really a hypocrite. And his marriage to Barbara Eden was crumbling. And his son was kidnapped. And through the trials and the crises in his life, he turned out to be a better guy. Well, I liked that kind of role. So in Rod Serling's Night Gallery, I played a father who had a wayward son. I just couldn't get him to behave. So I put him in this military academy that was very strict and from which he would never emerge, as it turned out. You learned as I got him submitted to the prep school kind of thing, that he would be kept in solitaire, but he would be given things to do. He would be kept under guard, and it would be the same as life imprisonment. I just submitted him to an institution from which he would never emerge, and drove away satisfied. I mean, that was the Night Gallery episode, very much against type. I would never have done that in real life, but sometimes, for an actor, it's fun to play somebody that is very 180 degrees from who you really are.
Definitely. Speaking of going out of character, you threw everyone a curveball in 1997 when you issued an album of heavy metal tunes done up in your own style called In a Metal Mood, No More Mr. Nice Guy. You had a who's who of heavy metal playing with you, like Ronnie James Dio, Dweezil Zappa, and Ritchie Blackmore. You appear on the cover of that album in a black leather outfit. I understand you caught some criticism for making that record. What inspired you to make it?
And by the way, you left out Sheila E., I think, who was also playing percussion on the album. Well, I was in England with some of my musicians that had been with me a long time, and we were between shows waiting at an airport for the next plane to the next English town. And the musicians were just saying, we enjoy playing all your hit records, and the audience loves them, of course, but why don't we go in a studio, just us, and make another record and do something new? And I said, guys, what could I do I haven't done 10 times already? This was well into my career. I'd had hit records with country, gospel, rhythm and blues, movie themes, patriotic songs, just about everything you can think of. I said, what could I do? What could we do I haven't done 10 times already? And somebody jokingly said, well, you never did any heavy metal. And we laughed at that, and then we kidded for several months, when are we going to get together and do our heavy metal record? And then my conductor, Dave Siebels, one day said, we've been kidding about that, but there are some really good songs that are only known as heavy metal songs. And they're actually good melodies, good lyrics, and only known to metalheads. So we could do those songs in a new way, a different way, and maybe come up with a hit. And I said, well, what do you mean a different way? He said, well, how about big band jazz? These are rocking good songs, and we could do them with big band jazz orchestrations. I said, man, I love that idea. Well, tell me what kind of songs you're talking about. So they made me a cassette of Jimi Hendrix and Van Halen and Alice Cooper and Metallica and AC/DC and Led Zeppelin and all of these. And I began to hear underneath all the cacophony and the screaming, and the unintelligible lyrics and the distortion in the music, all of that, I heard some really good songs. So I said, let's do it. And my conductor wrote the first arrangements of Enter Sandman and Stairway to Heaven. And at that point, the word got out that I was doing an album of heavy metal songs with a whole different approach. And MCA, that owned all my early recordings with Dot Records, called, Bruce Reznikoff called and said, are you making an album of heavy metal? I said, yes. It ought to be here with all your other recordings. I was going to do it as a custom album, not knowing if it could possibly get any attention. And so MCA gave us triple the budget we would have used ourselves. It was just going to be me and my five guys. But instead, we used a full, huge orchestra and singers and went to Ocean Way Studio. And oh, goodness, some of the big rock singers came in hearing I was doing this just to be in the studio, in the control room, hearing me sing their songs. And, of course, Dweezil Zappa playing a Hendrix Stratocaster on Smoke on the Water. And we made this rocking good big band, good music album. And Dick Clark heard we were doing it and even heard the pre-release. It was to come out the next day after the American Music Awards. And so he asked, he thought it was going to be a hit, which it became. And he asked Alice Cooper and me to swap images and present the award for Hard Rock Heavy Metal on the American Music Awards. And his idea was that Alice or Cooper would wear a V-neck sweater and white buck shoes and pull his hair back under a golf cap and carry a glass of milk and come out with me in the total black leather tattoos, choker, chains, shades, boots as a heavy metal guy. And we would swap images and present the award. And so we agreed to do it. Bill Ballou, who made Elvis's stage outfits, made me the leather outfit with no sleeves, no shirt, just a vest so I could show my chest and have tattoos on both pecs and choker and boots and all that, looking like a real heavy metal apparition. And, of course, Cooper looking like Mr. America with white buck shoes. Well, we were at the American Music Awards. The show was on. It was about a half hour till Cooper and I were to go on. And he backed out. He said, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to wear bucks and carry a glass of milk. He said, I'm just not comfortable doing that. And I was in a tuxedo at that time. And he said, I'm just going to dress like I normally do. And so I didn't tell him that I was going to go ahead and do Dick Clark had asked me to do and already had Bill Ballou make this costume and all that. So I surprised Cooper himself, the king of shock rock, when he introduced me as the future of heavy metal, which would have made no sense at all if I'd walked out in a tuxedo. That would have been ridiculous. Instead, I came out with leather tattoos and stalking like, a real heavy metal rocker anyway. And the crowd went nuts. They couldn't believe what they were seeing. And the young people, I'm sure, were saying, who is that? And the older ones were saying, well, they said it's Pat Boone, but it can't be. It can't be Pat Boone. And it was such a hubbub and cacophony of noise that we couldn't go on right away with the show. So I walked out to the front of the stage in my persona as a heavy metal defiant kind of guy and stood there glaring at the audience like, hey, you got a problem with me? You want a piece of this? You know, but I didn't have a mic. It had to be with just gestures and posture. And then I gave a couple of defiant flexes of my pectoral muscles with made the two little tattoos dance inside the open vest and went back, and Cooper was standing there with his mouth hanging open. Because he'd never seen the outfit. He didn't even know what I was supposed to look like. And here he was, just his normal Alice Cooper look. And so the script called for him to say, does this mean I have to sing Love Letters in the Sand? And say, that would be nice. But I had notified the sound man, when he says, does this mean I have to sing Love Letters in the Sand? I said, turn up some kind of effects, echo, whatever you can to make my voice sound different. And I leaned down and loud, I said, that would be nice. And it was reverberating through the Shrine Auditorium. And again, Cooper backed away in absolute shock. And then we gave the award for Hard Rock Heavy Metal to Metallica. And I had done their song, Enter Sandman, and they came up bowing to me and saying I was their new lead singer. Well, Dick Clark said later they'd had many, many, astounding things on his show. that they never had anything that was immediately the top lead item on the news that night on TV and in the newspapers the next day on front pages around the world of me in leather tattoos as a heavy metal freak. And, of course, I got kicked off Christian television immediately because the folks who were running the Christian shows where I was always welcome and desired, it looked like I had sold out and gone off to the dark side, not realizing this was just a promotion, really, like going to a party wearing a costume. And in a couple of months, we got it all straightened out, and I was back in good graces and on Christian TV again. And the record, because of the hubbub it created, went to halfway up the Billboard chart the first week. MCA had a huge hit with that album. It went to number 3 on the alternative chart, number 6 on the hard rock chart. It went way up the country charts. It was even on the weather reports. I mean, the people were so astounded that Pat Boone had made an album of heavy metal classics. And, of course, I'm very proud of it because it was good music. And so many other big hard rock heavy metal groups were begging me to do their songs. I was hearing from Poison, Scorpion, groups I've forgotten even how to pronounce, and AC/DC wanted me to do their songs. But there was no follow-up to it because MCA thought it was a fluke that the first record was a big hit because of the shock value, but they didn't believe we could follow that. I think they were wrong. I was already starting to pick out other songs. I'd already done Guns N' Roses Paradise City and things that nobody would have dreamed I would do, but I found they were very good songs.
Talk about your new record, Legacy.
Legacy, I call it that because that's something you leave for either future generations of your family or maybe for others. In my case, this may very well be my last album. And though I've recorded and had success in more genres of music, I think, than any other singer, I've checked on that, and I don't think there's any contradiction. Nobody, including Ray Charles, has had hit records in country, pop, rock and roll, heavy metal, gospel, patriotic, and movie themes, any genre, except outright jazz or classical, than I have. And so I figured, well, I can't record forever. While I can still sing, I'm going to do an album of songs I've written, all gospel from my own worship and my spiritual life, and songs I think and hope will be used after I'm gone, maybe, in worship and celebration and praise and church services. And they're not all just what I call super religious. They are thoughtful, worshipful, but entertaining songs that I think, well, first of all, they sum up my career and my everything I'm about in my life. That's why I call it Legacy. It's who I am. It's the way I want to be remembered. And so I leave this to folks who have liked me for any reason and say, folks, I want you to know this is who Pat Boone is and was, and this is what I think is important, and I hope you will also feel as important in your life. And that's why I call it Legacy.
Mr. Boone, thank you very much for this interview, and have a great day.
Thank you. You too.